What Agra is saying is that because Africa is a food deficit continent with chronic malnourishment, that they will use technology to save starving Africans. And their approach starts with improved seeds, seeds that will grow under different conditions and will have higher yields. They also are trying very much not to repeat the mistakes of the Green Revolution for Asia in India, Philippines, Pakistan, where, for instance, the seeds were used mainly by large-scale farmers, and small-scale farmers lost their land. So the Agra initiative is paying attention to smallholder farmers. They also understand that a major issue for distribution of food is marketing, and that infrastructure is lacking across most of Africa. No bridges, no warehouses, poor roads. Therefore, their approach is that they will help the food deficit continent through technology, paying attention to smallholder farmers, and through marketing and credit to the smallholder farmers. We, however, find this unacceptable because it is the technological bullet to try to solve what is a social political problem. And the African continent really doesn't need improved seed. They have a food base of about 2,000 plants. Their food is from biodiversity, not so much from yields. So one of the issues is, what are the improved seeds? The improved seeds in the 21st century, the new addition to a green revolution, are genetically modified seeds. Why genetically modified seeds? Their characteristics are not necessarily better than through normal breeding procedures, but genetically modified seeds can be patented. So therefore, you have a privatization of a major input resource to farmers, and they become the owners become DuPont and Monsanto, not the smallholder farmers who collectively share their seeds. The African continent is resisting this across the whole continent. All 54 countries say no patenting on life. They have a very difficult time enforcing that, but it is extremely widely accepted principle. Then the question is, well, the Gates Foundation is philanthropic. Why would they be doing this? The Gates Foundation has investment portfolios, and those portfolios are invested in biotech industries. And the accusation has been made that the Gates Foundation portfolios also have zero socially responsible criteria for their investments. So the foundation is making profit from biotech industries that are promoting genetically modified seed in order to feed food deficit Africa.
I know from reading one of your articles that you had pointed out that it was African nations that at the 1999 WTO ministerial had proposed no patenting of life forms, and that had been resisted by the U.S.
Yes. In fact, they brought a resolution that had been advocated unanimously across the continent from the African governments to Seattle, a resolution that says no patenting on life, and the United States government under President Clinton would not even allow it on the agenda in Seattle. But we also have to thank Seattle for a huge success story, and then that can give us energy to go ahead and confront what the Gates Foundation is doing with Agra. The success story is the World Trade Organization, which came into being in 1995, is the first international law to allow patenting on life forms. But in the 1995 version of the WTO, it's simply on microorganisms. And the intention, and it's throughout the documents in the WTO, was to expand that to patenting of plants by the year 2000. So moving from microorganisms to patenting of whole species. And because of the resistance against the WTO, in the streets of Seattle and Cancun and other places, resistance from organized farmers groups across Asia, Latin America, and Africa, and resistance by many governments. We're in 2008, and the WTO has no patenting on plants, still only a 1995 version of microorganisms. So Seattle initiated that resistance, and that's a huge success story that we should celebrate. It was a victory. It is a victory. There's no patenting on plants in the WTO.
Talk a bit more about Africa, where basically my understanding is, from your writings, that the solution already exists there, that they already have, with 2,000 different plants, they already have the methodologies for, you know, putting specific plants next to each other to fight the different diseases that the U.S. biotech companies are saying that their seeds will fight.
Yes, and in fact, one way to think about it is, if the Gates Foundation has so much money that they would like to contribute to world agriculture, food for people, not for profit, our suggestion, those of us who are opposing AGRA, is why doesn't the Gates Foundation give money to African farmers to come to the United States to help us save our agriculture and revitalize it? That's how important their agriculture is. So the money's going the wrong direction. We should be bringing African farmers here to Washington to work with organic farmers. A couple of examples of the alternatives that do exist. Besides the refusing the patenting, they are also talking about farmers' rights. So farmers' rights are collective rights, the ability of farmers to exchange seed, save seed, propagate seed, no matter whose seed it is. So they will not recognize the patents, because farmers are the scientists. Farmers are the ones who have given us the incredible biodiversity, and we cannot remove them from that particular task, or we will lose biodiversity. It's a bit ridiculous to have patenting of seed, because it reduces the gene pool for breeding further seed. So the corporations are destroying the very economic base, the very resource material that they need in order to stay in business. Farmers understand that. So one of the aspects on the African continent is to herald farmers' rights and to enshrine it in their laws. Another approach, which is well known in the United States, again among smallholder farmers, and so we should have farmer-to-farmer networking, is the intercropping and the biodiversity on the farm rather than monoculture. And then the intercropping, of course, helps reduce the pests and the pathogens, whereas if you have monoculture, it's a feast for the pathogens. One example in Ethiopia is that a genetically modified corn was introduced into Ethiopia, and Harvard Medical School actually did the research and found out that the pollen of that corn became a feast for the Anopheles mosquito, which is the propagator of malaria. So they were tracing the rise in the use in this the planting of this genetically modified corn with the rise in malaria in Ethiopia. And it was a direct connection, because that particular plant was a feast for the mosquito. Solution, coming from Harvard, is to re-genetically modify the corn rather than going back to teff, which is an indigenous crop in Ethiopia and extremely nutritious and can do everything, can feed in every way that corn can. So the intercropping, the diversity of that, and that also then means the sustaining and propagating their indigenous seeds. Therefore, the Africans are resisting by the kinds of laws that they're passing for farmers' rights, the organizing they're doing to oppose things like the Alliance for Green Revolution for Africa, and also by their production and their marketing. And this would be very useful. The United States, we're down to about 12 plants for 75% of our food. It would be quite nice to have some African crops here and help us regain our biodiversity.
That's very intriguing, the seed that promoted the mosquito, because again, you're looking at the Gates Foundation that's going out of their way to supposedly, you know, wipe out malaria. And I don't know that it's a specific company they have an investment in, but one of their brother companies is cranking out something that is helping produce more malaria.
Yes, and it's the belief by the Gates Foundation that technology can solve any of our problems across the globe. Again, be they production problems or social problems or economic exchange problems. But in fact, this technology is highly suspect. It cannot be proven to be safe. That's why there is a biosafety protocol that's an international treaty that the United States has not signed or ratified. And that biosafety protocol says we don't have to wait to show that something is proven to be safe before we can refuse it or ban it. Because quite like an atom bomb, once you release genes and pollen that could be dangerous, you can't call it back. So the biosafety protocol is in place, and again, the African continent has ratified it across the continent to protect against this loose use of technology. And to give another example, which the Gates Foundation is invested in, sorghum is another indigenous crop across the whole continent. The sorghum and millets together are the most widely used grain than all the other grains combined on the African continent. It is indigenous to Africa. It therefore grows across all kinds of ecological regions. And it is quite unexplored genetically. So we need African geneticists, African scientists to explore the genetic wealth of sorghum. It's also more nutritious than maize. We need investment. We need funds for that research. What the Gates Foundation is invested in instead is to genetically modify sorghum in Kenya so DuPont can patent it. And that's the difference in how the money is used.
Can you give us a sense of how many or how wide the genetic, the push for genetically modified seeds and organisms in Africa is right now?
Sure. It's a very good question. There's two countries where the genetically modified organism have taken root. Kenya is one, and that's where the Gates Foundation is based. And the other one is South Africa. And let me speak about South Africa because I work in the region of Southern Africa. The rest of the region of Southern Africa has said no to genetically modified organisms. Your audience might remember in 2002 that the country of Zambia even refused to eat genetically modified corn that came in as food aid. So not only do they not want to grow it, they don't want to eat it. But South Africa has accepted genetically modified plants, and all the soya and all the maize that you eat in South Africa is now genetically modified. And then what happens, and the organization I was with, Community Technology Development Trust in Zimbabwe, has research now that has actually documented the genetic pollution coming from South Africa. For example, the food crisis in Zimbabwe that we talked about earlier means that maize, corn will be coming from South Africa into Zimbabwe. It will be genetically modified. They will ship it in whole kernels, and therefore some of it will get planted. The organization, the community organization, actually was taking samples off of the sides of roads where the trucks transport the maize. And what is happening, therefore, is through the food aid from South Africa to Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe will be polluted with genetically modified maize, even though they have a national policy of no genetically modified organisms. Therefore, South Africa, with its economic power, with its ability to feed the region, is a very good conduit to force this technology on the rest of the 13 countries of Southern Africa. And it's quite explicit policy. One way you could avoid that is to ship in food aid that's already ground. So Zimbabweans have to eat the genetically modified maize, which is fine in a food crisis, but it will not genetically pollute the indigenous strains of maize in Zimbabwe, but it's going in as full kernels.
And I know the contamination also, in addition to spreading to these other plants and other regions, that another fallout from that is that the farmers can, the corporations that then have the patents on those can come in and go to these farmers whose crops are now contaminated and say, those are our seeds and you didn't pay for that and you owe us, because I know they've done that here with different farmers in North America.
Yeah, Monsanto is currently suing about 800 farmers in North America, and they're winning the suits. They're winning the suits in Canada and in the United States. And yes, that is the next tactic. When your field is polluted because a whole kernel food aid came in and took root or was planted, the corporation then comes in. And in fact, we already have on record that the corporations are saying that, well, this pollution, which was documented not only in Zimbabwe but in Namibia, Zambia, and Malawi, this pollution occurred because farmers are sharing their seeds, and farmers should not be sharing their seeds. So they take zero responsibility for a pollution which is an anathema to the biodiversity. And the biodiversity is our collective wealth, our collective treasure. And one reason the U.S. corporations are there is that Southern Africa is gene-rich. They don't have capital. They haven't got any cash. But they have genetic resources that are a treasure. And the United States is gene poor. So this is a marketing and production way to steal the genetic wealth from Southern Africa.
There's the other aspect of what's been going on with the pushing of U.S. agriculture around the world is the destruction of indigenous cultures at the privileging of our economic system and lack of culture, if you will, in agriculture. And I think that's another important part. And the teaching is about bringing it all together to celebrate the victories, as Carol was saying, and also to go deeper into how we can resist on a personal, community, and global level.
So it's like our cultural Terminator seed that we're spreading.
Exactly. So call that about industrial ag.
Real quick, websites people can go to.
SeattleGlobalJustice.org.
Okay. And Carol, do you have any website you want to?
The Association of Concerned Africa Scholar, which discusses these issues and others, is AfricaConcernedScholars.org.
And on genetic engineering, you could go to washback.org, which is the Washington Biotechnology Action Council. It has a lot of resources around looking at the intellectual property rights and GMOs.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. I want to thank you both for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Carol Thompson, professor of political economy at Northern Arizona University, co-author of Biopiracy of Biodiversity, Global Exchange as Enclosure, and Bill Al with the Community Alliance for Global Justice. They were speaking with Mike McCormick last December. It is not surprising, says Charles Eisenstein, that the words "the ascent of humanity" reverberate with a religious connotation, and that the myth of technological utopia is uncannily congruent to the religious doctrine of heaven, with technology as our savior. Omnipotent technology will repair the mess we have made of this world. It will cure all our social, medical, and environmental ills, just as we escape the consequences of our sins of this life when we ascend to heaven. It is our technology, however, that has created many of these ills. And Eisenstein argues one cannot use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. This, in a nutshell, is the ascent of humanity that Jacob Bernowski was referring to in his classic, The Ascent of Man, after which the present volume is ironically named. It is an ascent from the depths of superstition and ignorance into the light of scientific reason, an ascent from fear and powerlessness in the face of natural forces to the mastery of those forces. A myth is a story that provides a template for understanding ourselves and our world. As well, it is a program that guides our choices and priorities. Accordingly, I will distinguish the myth of ascent into two aspects: the scientific program of complete understanding and the technological program of complete control. The technological program. Starting with stone tools and fire, technology has given us increasing control over nature, insulated us from her whims, and provided us with safety and comfort. In the past, we had very little control over the physical environment. We were at the mercy of nature. Present, although there are still many problems to be solved, we have made great strides in our ability to engineer and control nature. We have conquered many illnesses, reduced the hardship of survival, moved mountains and drained lakes, augmented the processing power of our own brains with computers. Future, someday our control over nature will be complete. We will prolong human life indefinitely, eliminate pain and suffering, eliminate labor, travel to the stars, and leave Earth behind entirely. The scientific program. By making methodological observations of the universe and creating and testing theories, we replace myth and superstition with the growing body of objective knowledge. Past. We had very little understanding of the laws of the universe, so we resorted to myth and superstition in a vain attempt to explain the world. Present. While there are still many things about the universe that we do not understand, we have discovered at least the basic framework of how the universe works. The laws of gravity, quantum mechanics, evolution, and so forth. We can explain most of the phenomena we observe, and we have plausible theories about the rest. Myth and superstition have no place. Future. Someday our understanding of nature will be complete. We will formulate a theory of everything that combines relativity and quantum mechanics into a single equation and apply that theory to explain any and all observed phenomena. There will be no more mysteries. Even the workings of the human brain will be fully understood according to scientific principles. Together, the scientific program and the technological program form a defining myth of our civilization. The two are intimately related. Technology, our ability to control the world, arises from science, the means by which we understand and explain the world. Technology, in turn, provides the means for science to probe even more deeply into the remaining mysteries of the universe. Technology also proves the validity of science. If our scientific understanding of the world were no better than myth and superstition, then the technology based on that science wouldn't work. Philosophers of science will protest that it is already well established, even in conventional circles, that perfect knowledge and perfect control of the universe is probably impossible, due to such things as mathematical incompleteness, quantum indeterminacy, and sensitive dependence on initial conditions. Be that as it may, this information has yet to filter down to the level of popular consciousness, even among scientists. What I am talking about is the faith encapsulated in the saying, "Science will surely explain it someday." It is the faith that the answer is there, that the answer is accessible to science, and that science itself is well grounded in its primary principles and methods. The technological corollary to this faith in science is our faith in the technological fix. Whatever the problem, the solution lies in technology. Finding a way to solve the problem, science will find an answer. Technology will find a way. Underlying the technological problem is a kind of arrogance that we can control, manage, improve on nature. Many of the dreams of gee whiz technology are based on this. Control the weather, conquer death, download your consciousness onto a computer, onward to space. All of these goals involve controlling or transcending nature, being independent of the earth, independent of the body. Nanotechnology will allow us to design new molecules and build them atom by atom. Perhaps someday we will even engineer the laws of physics itself. From an initial status of subordination to nature, the technological program aims to give us mastery over it, an ambition with deep cultural foundations. Descartes' aspiration that science would make us the lords and possessors of nature merely restated an age-old ambition. And God said unto them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth, Genesis 1:28. Yet a contrary thread runs concurrently through the world's religious traditions, a recognition of the hubris of our attempt to improve on nature. Greek mythology has given us the figure of Daedalus, who arrogated to himself the power of flight in violation of ordinary mortal limitations. The power to transcend nature's limitations is for the gods alone. And for his temerity, Daedalus was punished when his son Icarus soared too high in his desire to attain the heavens. In the Bible, we find a similar warning in the Tower of Babel, a metaphor for the futility of reaching the infinite through finite means. Have we not, through our technology, attempted to rise above nature, sickness, uncertainty, death, and physical limitation, to attain an immortal estate? And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Utopia Postponed. The 1960s were in many ways the summit of our civilization. We had beaten polio, smallpox, and plague. Surely cancer and the rest of the world would succumb in due course. We had beaten the Nazis. Surely the commies were next to go. Social problems like poverty, racism, illiteracy, crime, and mental illness would be engineered out of existence. Everything pointed to unlimited growth and continued triumph. Atomic power, robots, space, artificial intelligence, maybe even immortality. But in the words of Patrick Farley, the future has been running a little behind schedule. Hence, the technology was not the vehicle of utopia began to emerge early in the Industrial Revolution, but its successes were so spectacular that it was easy to believe that social and environmental problems were merely temporary impediments, engineering challenges we would overcome through the same methods, mindsets, and techniques that had solved previous problems. More technology, more control. Today, the successes are less spectacular, the crises harder to deny, the promise of utopia just around the corner more hollow, but we still act as though more control were the answer. For example, the medical establishment is having more and more trouble hiding the fact that, with the sole exception of emergency medicine, 40 years of, quote, advances have had little impact on human health and mortality. Consider the overall effect of the successes. Organ transplants were a real breakthrough, but their effect is limited to a few thousand patients annually. Most of the new pharmaceuticals merely control symptoms, often with severe side effects. Hormone replacement therapy is turning out to be a disaster. The same for cholesterol-lowering medication, antidepressants, and many of the painkillers. When a new medicine is unveiled, a, quote, 20% improvement in outcomes among a significant group of patients, close quote, is considered a great success. Despite decades of huge investment, it appears that the age of dramatic cures is over. There has been no cure for any of the poster child diseases, such as muscular dystrophy and breast cancer. Certainly no major disease has been wiped out since we conquered the great killers of the 19th century. Coronary artery disease has retreated little, if at all, in 30 years. Cancer is doing just fine, thank you. Arthritis is just as devastating as ever. Strokes nearly as common. Alzheimer's disease on the rise. Meanwhile, a host of formerly uncommon conditions, for which conventional medicine can offer palliative remedies at best, have grown into epidemics. Diabetes, autism, allergies, multiple sclerosis, lupus, obesity, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, multiple chemical sensitivities, inflammatory bowel syndrome, chronic fungal infections, and many others. Not only have formerly rare diseases become epidemic, but entirely new diseases such as AIDS have appeared seemingly out of nowhere. Finally, to add insult to injury, some of the conquered diseases of the past, such as tuberculosis, seem to be making a comeback, usually due to antibiotic resistance. This state of affairs constitutes a great unspoken crisis in medicine. Despite unprecedented billions of dollars in pharmaceutical research, medicine seems to be losing ground in the battle against disease. Typically, the response is more technology, more precise control at the genetic and molecular level, a continued search for the cure. Life expectancy has similarly failed to live up to predictions. For half a century now, futurists have been predicting dramatic increases in life expectancy. There is no reason why 120 years shouldn't be common. Perhaps with gene therapy, this could be extended indefinitely. A glance at the statistics, however, shows the most dramatic gains in life expectancy all occurred in the first half of the 20th century, not since 1970. From 1900 to 1950, life expectancy at birth rose by an impressive 21 years. Since then, it has risen only 9 years. Moreover, much of this improvement must be due to lower infant mortality and emergency life-saving procedures. Because if we look at the life expectancy at age 65, we find a paltry 4-year increase over the past half century. Gains in life expectancy show the same familiar pattern of diminishing marginal returns that we see in the agricultural application of fertilizer. The first application of technology, fertilizer, brings dramatic results, but subsequent applications have less and less benefit until enormous amounts are eventually required to boost yields a tiny bit, or even to prevent yields from falling. As burgeoning healthcare expenditures demonstrate, we are presently pouring enormous technological effort into healthcare with only tiny gains compared to the dramatic improvements that accompanied the comparatively modest expenditures of the early 20th century. We can expect that unless the fundamental direction of medical technology changes, life expectancy will stagnate and probably even begin to fall within 10 years. Nor has technology lived up to its promise to usher in an age of leisure. In the United States, leisure time did seem to be increasing throughout the 20th century until about 1973, when it began a gradual, sustained decline. Most researchers agree that leisure time has decreased in the 30 years since then. We are spending more time working, more time commuting, more time running errands, more time meeting the obligations of life. The computer, trumpeted as the final key technology that would do for the drudgery of mental labor what machines had supposedly done for physical labor, has brought about the opposite. More time spent in offices, at desks, at keyboards. By now it is apparent that the computer has not eliminated the drudgery of office work any more than the steam engine eliminated the ordeal of physical labor. Despite the information revolution, few people would argue that office work has become more intellectually stimulating and meaningful in the last 30 years. The solution? Again, it is more technology, more labor-saving devices, greater efficiency, better time management. Technology has similarly failed to bring about a world of plenty. While the food supply has indeed grown enough to feed a doubled world population, hunger and famine are no less prevalent, and for the same old political and environmental reasons, war, repression, and drought. Moreover, vast areas of land that were once agriculturally productive have turned to desert, so that we face the prospect of a food crisis, not a cornucopia. At the present writing, world grain stocks are in decline, and most of the great fisheries nearly depleted. The last 40 years of, quote, development in the third world have not brought the promised prosperity. To the contrary, the gap between rich and poor has widened globally and within third world countries themselves. Travel in the third world and you can easily see for yourself that destitution, disease, and dislocation of our own industrial revolution are still common today. And the justification is the same, too. It's just a temporary phase before you become a developed nation like us. We had to go through it, and so do you. It is the natural order of things. The prescription, then, is again more of the same further advances in agriculture and more vigorous economic development. Now, people around the world are starting to disbelieve this dogma simply because a decline in third world living standards has continued unabated for too long. That wasn't supposed to happen. In many Latin American countries, the middle class has almost disappeared altogether. In space, the triumphs of the 1960s and 1970s never led to the space colonies, Mars landings, and interstellar space travel that were confidently predicted by the year 2000. There have been essentially no significant advances in propulsion technology since the rocket, developed some 70 years ago. When I was growing up in the early 1970s, space fever gripped the minds of all my contemporaries. We had space board games, space lunchboxes, even, I recall, rocket-shaped shampoo bottles. We landed on the moon. Then we did it again and again. We have not returned to the moon since the 1970s, however, and there is little enthusiasm for such a mission today. Been there, done that, where has it led? At the time of this writing, President Bush has just proposed a new drive to establish a permanent moon base and a manned mission to Mars, yet there is not even a shadow of the excitement that enthralled the nation in the early days of my childhood. The age of leisure and easy plenty, technotopia, is forever just around the corner. First, it was the age of coal that was supposed to free us from labor. In the dawning golden age of the 19th century, coal-fired, steam-driven machines would do all the work. Instead, we got the sweatshop, the coal mine, the foundry, the satanic mills, and the Stygian forces, no idle metaphor, these. The 80-hour work week, child labor, industrial accidents, starvation wages, fabulous wealth alongside wretched slums, childhood spent in coal mines, horrific pollution, shattered communities, and ruined lives. But not to worry, the golden age was just around the corner. Thanks to electricity, chemistry, the automobile, nuclear power, rockets, computers, genetic engineering, nanotechnology. Unfortunately, none of these ever quite lived up to their promise. And now we are in the 21st century, which was supposed to have been the age of leisure, the information age, the knowledge economy. In the latter phrase, some key prejudices of the ascent myth are laid bare. It implies a progression from the industrial age, mired in materiality, to a separate, exclusively human realm of pure knowledge. The base concerns of material production were to be left behind to less advanced countries, and our society was to have risen above that to deal in the products of the mind. Eventually, with the perfection of robotics, all societies were to follow us there. The aspiration to rise above materiality defines modern religion as much as it does modern economics and modern technology. This is no accident. All arise from a common source that I will discuss throughout this volume. All are variations on the theme of ascent, the ascent of humanity. Materiality, after all, is just a pejorative word for nature, and we identify the ascent of humanity with a progressive transcendence of nature. Once nature's slave, now its master. So, of course, it is higher, better, more ascended to be in the realm of the mind in the realm of base material production. This is why occupations such as executive and consultant carry a cachet absent from industrial engineer and plumber. For the last 20 years or more, young people have aspired to such roles without even caring what their actual subject matter is. They major in business, marketing, and finance, hoping to be an executive somewhere, anywhere. Part of the reason is the wealth and status that accord to such occupations, but a deeper principle is at work too, the separation of spirit and matter, mind and body, human and nature, that is as old as civilization. From the first social division of labor, prestige went to those whose hands were not sullied by the dirt. The soil of farming at first, but eventually the entire material world. Thus it was that the ancient king's feet were not allowed to touch the earth. Today's knowledge worker was supposed to be the consummation and democratization of that trend. Every man a king. The bankruptcy of the ambition encoded in the words knowledge economy is now becoming plain. Office work is no less tedious than that of the assembly line or vegetable monofarm. And for the same systemic reasons, I will describe in Chapter 2. Much of today's knowledge economy consists of data input. Furthermore, the recent migration of knowledge-intensive jobs, such as engineering and computer programming, to new industrial powerhouses, such as India and China, demonstrates that the realms of mind and matter are not so separate as we might wish to think. The promise of utopia just around the corner to justify today's sacrifices is a common thread connecting every application of the technological program. We saw it in the age of coal. We see it in the computer revolution today. We must undertake the vast project of inputting all the data. Then computers will run everything much more efficiently. We see it in the third world, in the IMF's austerity programs, which call for sacrifice today to bring prosperity tomorrow. IMF policies are often criticized as instruments of globalization that benefit the already wealthy, but their systemic necessity springs from a much deeper source than that. Sacrifice is a built-in feature of any capitalist system based on interest-bearing money. Sacrifice now to scrape together the money that breeds money. Even more fundamentally, it is a defining mindset of agriculture in which you must sow today in order to reap tomorrow. The same mentality affects religion, which calls upon us to sacrifice worldly pleasures for the sake of a hypothetical future heaven. The problem with all this is that, whether in the third world or in the endless task of data input, the sacrifice seems to be perpetual. Heaven never comes. Speaking from the bowels of the Industrial Revolution, William Wordsworth said it best. With you I grieve when on the darker side of this great change I look, and there behold such outrage done to nature as compels the indignant power to justify herself. And then in full many a region once like this the assured domain of calm simplicity and pensive quiet and unnatural light prepared for never resting labor's eyes breaks from a many-windowed fabric huge, and at the appointed hour a bell is heard, a local summons to unceasing toil. Men, maidens, youths, mothers, and little children, boys and girls, enter, and each the wonted task resumes within this temple where it is offered up to gain the master idol of the realm, perpetual sacrifice. Perpetual sacrifice. It is an ideology that invades nearly every aspect of our lives. What is being sacrificed? What is the common thread? Most fundamentally, it is a sacrifice of the present for the future. Cut back today so you will have enough for tomorrow. Work comes before play. No pain, no gain. Control yourself. Whether it is in diet, education, or personal development, we find the same sad prescription. Why is it that for so many people, the heaven of physical fitness or financial independence or cessation of an addiction remains forever just as distant as technological utopia? How long do your New Year's resolutions last? Well, try harder. It's like the man who decided to walk to the horizon and, failing to get there, concluded that he needed to run instead. This book will uncover the origins and evolution of the regime of perpetual sacrifice that we have endured in our attempt to build a tower to heaven. Because the exhilarating gee-whiz aspect of technology has failed to deliver the futuristic wonderama we all expected in the 1960s, the dark side of technology has become more difficult to ignore. Certainly, there has been ample evidence for centuries that technology is not an unqualified good, but until the 20th century, the ideology of progress dominated all but the most independent thinkers. The horrific conditions of the Industrial Revolution could be explained as merely a temporary sacrifice on the way to utopia. Only a few romantics had the vision to resist this ideology, people like William Blake, Wordsworth, Lord Byron, Henry David Thoreau, and Mary Shelley, who saw the ruination within mass industrial society not as a temporary phase or an engineering challenge, but as its fundamental character. All this started to change in 1914, when the world finally got to see the result of industrialization applied to warfare. Battlefield carnage on the mass scale of industry. A whole generation of young men decimated, extending 30 years later to encompass entire civilian populations in the conflagration of total war, and ending in the first application of the century's greatest scientific triumph, the atomic bomb. At that same time, the organizational principles of the Industrial Revolution, based on the same scientific tools of analysis and control, reason, logic, and efficiency, were applied to the purposeful mass extermination of innocent people under Hitler, Stalin, and their imitators. Ironically, it was precisely these principles of logic, reason, and efficiency that were supposed to elevate humanity to a more noble state, just as the technologies of physical and chemical engineering used in the world wars were supposed to elevate humanity to a new level of material comfort, health, and security. The irony was not lost on artists, writers, and other cultural sensitives who have been grappling with the resulting feelings of betrayal and despair ever since. From Plato onward, utopian philosophers thought that reason, planning, and method would bring the same progress to the social realm as material technology brought to the physical. Social planning would conquer the wilderness of human nature, just as technology subdued the wilderness of physical nature. The failure of both is seen merely as evidence that we need more of the same. The ambition of nanotechnology to extend physical control to a new level of microscopic precision parallels the social technologies of education and law as they strive toward ever finer regulation of human behavior. Underlying both material technology and sociopolitical methods of control, we find the same conceptual foundation. Is it mere accident that from this foundation, the same decimation has visited both the human and natural realm? Obviously, there is a flaw in the common position that technology is neutral, up to us to use for good or evil. The pogroms and the genocides, the ethnic cleansings and wars of extermination, the despoilation of the planet and the wrecking of indigenous cultures, all these are attributed to the misuse of technology, not technology itself. But perhaps this position is mistaken. Perhaps something basic to the very mindset of technology has generated the twin crises in the social and environmental realm. In some quarters, the faith in technology continues. Ozone layer destruction? We'll make new ozone. Soil erosion? We'll find a way to grow food without soil. Maybe we'll just synthesize it. Total environmental collapse? No matter, we'll colonize the stars. Who needs nature anymore? The can-do spirit that has brought us this far will surely overcome any future obstacles. Human ingenuity is unlimited. If things seem to be getting worse, not better, if people seem to be getting sicker, busier, and more anxious, if life seems more stressful and the environment less healthy, rest assured, this is a temporary sacrifice, one step backward necessary to take a giant leap forward. Today, though, the rhetoric of progress is wearing thin. It looks as though the future, always just around the corner, is never going to come. Since the mid-20th century, that feeling of betrayal and despair has spread beyond artists and intellectuals to engulf the entire population. Superficially, many people still affirm that the onward march of technology will someday render all our present problems obsolete, but on a deeper level they have lost confidence in both science and technology. The long-promised marvels, the next step in our transcendence of nature, have failed to materialize, while new and unforeseen problems multiply faster than we can solve them. Gone is the 60s optimism that sparked the war on poverty, the war on cancer, the conquest of space. Now we merely hope to stave off the problems that threaten to overwhelm us, the convergence of crises in the environment, health, education, the economy, and politics. The addiction to control. Whereas technology once promised a grand future of leisure and security, today we need intensifying doses of it merely to keep the world from falling apart. A pattern of diminishing marginal returns seems to have infiltrated all areas of technology, whether material or social. Early in the 20th century, modest expenditures in medical research brought enormous improvements in lifespan. Today, vast outlays barely succeed in maintaining present standards. In agriculture, small amounts of chemical fertilizers and pesticides once brought huge increases in crop yields. Today, an ever greater chemical input can hardly prevent yields from falling, despite, quote, improved varieties. In daily life, inventions such as cellular phones, personal digital assistants, convenience foods, and the internet barely enable us to keep pace with the ever-quickening modern life. Recently, I had a conversation with a longtime Washington, D.C. native who was recalling the building of the Beltway back in the 1960s. Everyone was excited because you'd be able to circumnavigate the whole city in just an hour. D.C. was starting to have traffic jams, and the Beltway would usher in a new era of ease and convenience. While everyone knows what happened, the new road facilitated new real estate development and encouraged people to use cars rather than public transport. Soon the Beltway was jammed. The solution? Make it wider and add even more roads. Of course, that caused even more development and congestion. The immediate engineering solution? More roads to accommodate an excessive car-to-road ratio worsens the problem in the long run. This is a classical example of a technological fix. Technology usually has unintended consequences, often including, as in this case, a worsening of the problem the technology was supposed to solve. Generally speaking, unintended consequences are not the result of sloppy engineering, lazy planning, or lack of diligence. They cannot be eliminated through tighter control. Rather, they are built into the very attempt of control. By now, this pattern of escalating dosage for a diminishing effect may remind you of another meaning of the word fix, a drug fix. Our dependency on technology shares many features in common with drug addiction. Returning to the example of agriculture, once we've killed the natural predators, lost the topsoil, depleted the minerals, and so on, we really cannot grow crops at all without repeated applications of more and more technology. Each fix brings some temporary improvement, but then crop yields start falling and we need another fix. At this point, we're hooked. If we go back to zero fertilizer, crop yields will fall way below the original pre-fertilizer level. Eventually, the soil is so damaged that no amount of fertilizer can coax life from it. The parallel with the course of addiction is uncanny. Escalating dosage to get a less and less intense high, followed ultimately by complete desolation. The history of life expectancy related above is another example. The dosage of technology must go up and up at a greater and greater expense to the rest of life in order to achieve diminishing returns. Eventually, addicts tell us, huge doses of the drug are needed to feel just normal. In parallel, huge medical expenditures are needed to even keep people functioning at all. Half of American adults take some form of prescription medication. The average senior citizen takes between 2 and 7 per day. In the beginning of Terry Gilliam's dark science fiction film Brazil, the main character's aunt has gotten some minor plastic surgery to fix a blemish on her face. We see her with a little bandage. The next time we see her, there are 2 or 3 larger bandages because there were complications from the initial surgery. The next time, bandages cover most of her face because she has had a new surgery to fix the complications of the second surgery, which was to fix the complications of the first. By the end, her whole head is swaddled in bandages. Each time she says something like, "It's almost perfect," or, "The doctors tell me it will just be a matter of 1 or 2 more procedures," a series of incremental improvements ends up in total ruin. Why is a technological fix so attractive? Because, from the short-term perspective, it really does work. The first digging stick really did make it easier to obtain roots. A cup of coffee really does make us feel energized. A good stiff drink really does make the pain go away. Air conditioning makes us feel cooler on a hot day. Cars get us there faster. Fertilizer boosts the yield. With each stage of construction, the tower rises higher. See, it's working. We're getting closer to the sky. Invisible at first is the fact that the fix is a trap. At the end of the day, the coffee exhausts our adrenal glands and makes us more tired, not less. Air conditioning habituates us to a narrow range of comfort, trapping us indoors. Cars inevitably bring more roads, more cars, and more time in transit, not less. Food production technology brings population increases and eventually less security and more anxiety. Ultimately, even the immediate efficacy of the fix diminishes. The problems that once ameliorated grow to overwhelming proportions. Today, new technology can barely keep pace with the acceleration of modern life, the proliferation of new threats, new diseases, and new uncertainties. Eventually, the alcoholic becomes so sick that each drink causes more pain than it removes. The principle of diminishing marginal returns that characterizes the technological fix was explored by archaeologist Joseph Tainter in his classic work, The Collapse of Complex Societies. Tainter says that a society's investments in complexity bring fewer and fewer benefits until its maintenance alone consumes all resources. Bureaucracies, legal systems, technological systems, and complex divisions of labor solve a society's immediate problems and achieve dramatic initial returns, but come with hidden costs. These costs may be exported into the future, delayed in their manifestation through growth and conquest. Eventually, though, in a pattern that has repeated itself from ancient Sumer to Rome and now to the American Empire, the society collapses under the weight of the structure it has erected. First, the burden grows heavy. Then one crisis after another is barely averted. The leadership degenerates into corruption, the environment deteriorates, and finally one or another crisis, something the civilization could have easily overcome in its youth, deals the final blow. The society collapses to a state of much diminished complexity. I find in the Babel story an allegory for this process. The organizational overhead required to manage an increasingly complex project manifests as growing confusion, an inability to communicate across the vast range of specializations and subsystems that need to be coordinated. In the Bible story, the builders find themselves speaking different languages, unable to communicate, unable to unite in a common task, a situation eerily prescient of the specialized jargon that separates each scientific and professional field and stalls meaningful progress. In the story, the tower is eventually abandoned. In my mind's eye, I picture its abandonment, preceded by frantic attempts to shore it up, to repair the proliferation of cracks and cave-ins that foretell its ultimate collapse. After the initial rapid progress slows and eventually stalls, the ambition of reaching the sky becomes a mere dogma, an ideology that no one believes. Such is our attitude toward the technological utopia I describe in Section 1. No one believes it anymore. Indeed, it consumes all our efforts to even maintain the tower at its present height. Even as we make an addition here and there, other parts crumble, and a spreading infirmity undermines its very foundations. The parallel to the life of the addict is uncanny. Easy to maintain at the beginning, the addiction soon demands increasingly complex structures to support it. The addict sacrifices long-term for short-term benefits, establishes webs of deceit that must eventually fail, and devotes more and more resources to maintaining the addiction. Get my fix today, deal with the consequences tomorrow. The consequences build and build, the burden on life grows, and eventually the whole fragile structure collapses. Just as the immediate cause of the collapse varies from person to person, so we must look beyond the proximate causes for the collapse of civilizations as well. On one level, yes, it will be the energy crisis, or an economic depression, or a military defeat, or an environmental crisis, or a combination of these, or something totally different that will end our civilization. The immediate cause is impossible to predict, but the end result is inescapable. And I've been reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises that is Birthing the Transition. And you can find out more about this fabulous book and the author's other writing at ascentofhumanity.com. And download an MP3 of this and all previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Thank you for listening. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. The rich will come down.